to Vegas with special guest Alex Porat. For more information and to buy tickets, visit kppconcerts.com.
Hey, students. Have you stumbled in your course and want a fresh start? Well, At the Best University has your back. AU offers more than 850 courses that align to your program, so you can retake your course online, turn that grade around, improve your GPA, explore new subjects, and study from anywhere. Visit atthebestu.ca to browse our online courses and transform your education today.
Over the last three seasons, the Queens Gaels have had the Ottawa GGs number. These teams have played seven times since 2021, and Queens has walked away victorious on all seven occasions. For each of the last 3 years, Ottawa's season has ended at Richardson Memorial Stadium. But with every game played, the margin of victory gets tighter and tighter. In 2023, the Gaels won their two matchups by seven total points. On Saturday, September 14th, the two Titans of the OUA East rekindle their rivalry once more as the Gaels make the short trip up the 416 to play the GGs in Ottawa. Will the Gaels make it an elite eight in a row, or will the GGs finally snap their post-pandemic losing streak? Tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM at 2:45 for the pregame show ahead of the 3 p.m. kickoff. We hope to see you then.
Danger, danger. The following contains explicit content. Please use caution while you are tuned in.
Hi, I'm Saida Garrett, co-writer of Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mr. Mark Tara.
The views and opinions expressed on the following program are those of the persons appearing on the program.
Today on Rainbow Country, Paul and Trisha, The Art of Fluidity. A new documentary about visual artist Paul Whitehead, who's worked with the likes of Genesis, The Beatles, Peter Gabriel. That and more in episode 421, so stay tuned. The Gay Talk Radio right here on Rainbow Country.
Hi, this is Emily Saliers from Indigo Girls.
Hey everyone, this is Chris Harder, porn star, burlesque performer, and the creator of Porn to Be a Star. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Well, hello and welcome to a brand new journey through Rainbow Country. As I like to call it, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. And as always, I am your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm producer and host, Mark Tara. By the way, Rainbow Country originates from CIUT-FM in Toronto and now proudly in syndication across Canada from coast to coast to coast. The Yukon, British Columbia, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, the east coast of Canada in Newfoundland, Ontario, even down to Buffalo, New York, and online. Well, thanks to you tuning in, streaming, downloading, but ultimately listening. Together, we continue to build Rainbow Country into a nationally syndicated gay radio show, as well as being recognized as a number one Canadian LGBT podcast. So today, The Art of Fluidity, a new documentary that's out right now on visual artist Paul Whitehead, who's worked with the likes of The Beatles, Peter Gabriel, and Genesis. Plus in hour two, music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. And on this episode, I'm featuring some Canadian disco, some queer country, and more. all that lies ahead as we start Journey 421 through Rainbow Country. And our first stop, the Rainbow Country Bookstore. Today, award-winning playwright and author Brad Fraser reads from his memoir, All the Rage. By the way, Brad Fraser's memoir, All the Rage, is available wherever you get your favorite books. And on Amazon.ca, All the Rage has a rating of 4.5 out of 5 stars.
That autumn, Kate left town to do a show, and Tad sublet his place and moved in with me. One autumn night after leaving the club with Richard, the three of us went for a bite at a nearby restaurant. Afterwards, we took a shortcut through the alley that ran next to the Odeon Theater. By the time we were partway up the alley, we realized we were being followed by four men about our age. We shared a quick look and quickened our step. Our pursuers did the same, saying they were going to take Tad's fleece-lined leather coat off him. Tad said to them, "Come on, guys, we don't need any trouble." They laughed. We could hear them whispering, "Faggots, cocksuckers, why are you walking so fast? Scared?" We were terrified. We were also three guys who worked out, and they didn't look all that big. Just as we emerged from the alley across the street from the Hudson's Bay store, they rushed us. I could feel adrenaline flushing through my system. My father didn't teach me much in my childhood, but he did teach me how to put up a guard and throw a punch, and I started roaring insults at them in my most demonic voice. I blocked a couple of punches and slapped my attacker away just as I heard Tad call my name. Two of them were moving in on him. Richard was holding his own with his attacker, landing a few decent blows, so I punched one of Tad's assailants in the side of the head. He made a pained noise, and amazingly, they all took off. As we walked up Jasper Avenue, we were sky-high with our victory, giddy and shaky. We dropped Richard off at his place and continued on to mine. As we passed under the dark shadow of the old train overpass that used to cross Jasper Avenue just west of 109th Street, we became aware of footsteps behind us. Our hearts sank. The whispering started again. The quartet was back, and now we were just two. Eventually, I ended up at the gay bar. I checked my parka and sidled up to the bar. There were more staff than patrons, but I wasn't there for company. As I ordered my usual Labatt's Blue, I caught the eye of an emaciated older man in an expensive leather coat staring at me from the other side of the square bar. Something about him seemed familiar. He smiled. It was Benny. My old fuck bud, Benny, the beautiful muscle man with a fat uncut cock, melon-like ass cheeks, and girlishly smooth skin. It was obvious he was in the late stages of AIDS. As I moved around the bar to greet him, I tried to hide my shock behind a surprised smile, but he saw right through it. As we hugged, he said, "It's okay." And that was the extent of our conversation about his health. I took the stool next to his as he looked me over with a smile, saying, "You're all right?" I nodded. "Good," he said. "Some of the guys I fucked with, they're not all right." Having no idea how to respond, I said, "It's good to see you." "You too. When I first got sick, I was laid up for a while, but I read about you when I started traveling again." Something hit me. "What happened to your accent?" Benny always had that sexy Texan twang. I remembered what he'd told me about himself in our first few meetings, born in Texas, a couple of brothers, worked at something to do with the steel industry, sales maybe, had a life partner who was much younger, and a brother who'd gotten into drug trouble in South America. Benny said, "Everything I told you about myself is a lie." He went on to explain to me he wasn't from Texas. He was from someplace in the Maritimes, and he didn't work in the steel industry. He worked for a major coke cartel that was smuggling blow into the country. I was so gobsmacked. Most people have an alter ego, but queer people in those days often had many identities, mostly forged out of necessity. We did what we had to do in order to survive. Nonetheless, when he was done, all I could do was gape at him. I said, "Everything?" He said, "Except the stuff about my partner. That was real." I had no idea what to say. Benny said, "All those condos and apartments we fucked in were safe houses. You have no idea the danger I put you and other people in. I had some pretty nasty people after my ass." I shook my head in shock. He put his hand over mine. It was cool, already slightly dead. "So what's happening with you?" Then he ordered us two more beers, and I brought him up to date with my life, Pete, and the play. When I was done, I could tell he was tired, so I offered to see him back to his hotel, but he said he was fine. He got off the stool to hug me, and I could feel the bones move loosely beneath his skin like the last few pretzel sticks in a nearly empty bag. Benny said, "Don't waste a minute." I kissed him quickly.
In the 60s, before the internet, to find each other, queer people needed to actually get together in real space and real time. Since most places didn't tolerate our kind, depending on where you were, your options could be limited. Large cities might have a few specialized commercial spaces, but in the absence of those, it was basically public washrooms, parks, or house parties. They all had their downsides. Commercial spaces required you to spend money, and that's one of the reasons why they were mostly for men. Even in places as big as Toronto, there was seldom more than one lesbian bar at a time. Lesbians earned about 60% of the male wage and probably had more dependents. The economy just wasn't there. The old adage was, gay men go to restaurants, lesbians hold potlucks. Washrooms and parks were also pretty much boys only and could be dangerous, plus parks in the Canadian winter, not so good. You could freeze your willy off. House parties, you needed to know somebody, or know somebody who knew somebody, and so on, and be invited. In terms of commercial life, Montreal had led the pack, developing a sin city reputation during Prohibition in the U.S. in the 1930s. And where there's sin, there's always a place for us. Toronto the Good and Vancouver took a bit longer, but in 1974, Toronto had enough anonymity and a critical mass to produce a small commercial scene. At first, it was mostly straight bars where we were tolerated in a corner as long as we behaved. Next came a few straight-owned venues that served gay clientele. By the mid-70s, a new class of gay entrepreneurs emerged and started to open up on Church Street where rents were cheaper. But not everybody lived in Toronto or Montreal. In smaller centers, where businesses couldn't meet community needs, the lesbian and gay liberation movement of the 70s came up with a new model. Defy economics and do it for ourselves. We might not have a lot of capital, but we did have free labor. For example, the Lesbian Organization of Toronto established a non-profit community center in a ramshackle old Victorian house in 1977. It held dances and brunches and drop-ins and provided meeting spaces and a coffee house and hosted a phone line for a whole generation of women. Loot, as it was known, was following a strategy already developed elsewhere. In Saskatoon, the Zodiac Friendship Society opened its community center in 1973. Edmonton and Calgary soon followed suit. HALO, the Homophile Association of London, Ontario, started in 1974, and the Halifax Gay Alliance for Equality first began running dances in the Turret in 76 and later turned that into a community center. By the end of the decade, there was a network of lesbian and gay groups providing community spaces in dozens of medium-sized centers across Canada, volunteer-run and community-controlled. This is Tim McCaskill, a gay liberation dinosaur from another planet and author of Queer Progress.
Up next, the art of fluidity.
Hi, everybody. This is Gino Vanelli. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
As an artist, Al Whitehead interpreted the world around him.
Here we are, the playground. Welcome to my world.
creating dazzling works of art for legends in their time.
Over the course of my career, I've worked with some really great people, like Peter Gabriel, Peter Hamill from Van de Graaff, Genesis art director with John Lennon and the Beatles.
But despite his success, the one thing Paul couldn't express.
You learn very early on that what you do for a living as an artist doesn't conform with most people's norms.
Was his true self.
So they think you're a weirdo.
Until he...
To me, the actual transition takes place when I put the wig on.
Discovered her.
Power. Realize your power.
Go where you want to go.
I realized she's an identity. I want to be the prettiest me that I can be with all the physical handicaps I've got. So without thinking what you're doing, you just start work. I have this ambition to be the transgender Bob Ross.
Paul Whitehead.
I discovered that I didn't fit into a box.
Trisha Van Cleef.
By not fitting into that box.
Two people enjoined together by art.
You're going to upset people.
After a lifetime of artistic achievement.
As an artist, as a transgender person.
He learned his masterpiece.
It's not my purpose in life to make other people feel comfortable.
May have been herself.
My purpose in life is to make me feel comfortable.
Paul and Trisha. The art of fluidity.
Paul Whitehead, hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
I have to say, thank you so much for being here to have your voice, your story be heard by the LGBT community and beyond. So thank you for this, especially to talk about your documentary, Paul and Trisha, The Art of Fluidity. Paul and Trisha, The Art of Fluidity. This is a documentary essentially telling major aspects of your life, telling your life story. And here's my first question for you. Generally speaking, your general thoughts, what are your thoughts on this documentary about you and your story and your journey? What are your general thoughts?
I'm very pleased with it. It could have gone either way because from the very beginning, I said I wanted no input on the editorial content of it. Just, you know, make the documentary and draw your own conclusions. So it could have gone either way, you know. We started doing the filming originally because I needed like a 20, 25 minute loop movie to go in my art shows. You know, the sort of thing that they have in museums where you come in and there's a documentary going on a loop. And we started off shooting that, but it quickly became apparent that there was a bigger story to tell. And Sophia, the director, asked the producer if she could keep shooting. And he said, sure, carry on. So it finished up an hour and 15 minutes. And I think it's a very well-balanced, non-confrontational, very informative documentary about a person's life. You know, my life, obviously I'm living it day by day. I don't think it's unusual because it's my life. But when it's seen through this perspective, it's kind of interesting. I watched it a few weeks ago, almost like it wasn't about me. And I thought to myself, wow, this would be really interesting for people that don't know about this kind of lifestyle to get this glimpse into somebody's life, you know.
You just mentioned Fia Pereira. She is an award-winning filmmaker. She directed this documentary on you. So you just mentioned it all started with having a short film to be part of your art gallery exhibit. But who approached who? Like, did you approach like Fia or a filmmaking company? How did that all originally start?
Pre-COVID, I had a manager called Adam Fisk who was taking care of all my art gallery stuff. And he was Fia's boyfriend. He's another Englishman like me. And he lives in America. And he said, okay, well, yeah, we need to do a 20-minute film to go with the show. I said, fine. He said, well, my girlfriend's a director. So I said, okay, let's try that. So she came over a couple of times And there was just a chemistry between us. I felt very comfortable with her. She was very informed about the whole, you know, LGBTQ sort of issues. And the more we talked with each other, obviously, the more I revealed about my life, and she kept asking me different things, and I'd tell her different anecdotes about little things that happened in my life, and it just got going. It caught fire, you know. Mm-hmm.
Were you ever apprehensive, nervous about telling your story, especially telling certain aspects of your story?
Not really. I think I'm too old for that. I mean, it's... what's done is done, you know, you can't change it. And I'm not ashamed of anything in my life. I have an amazing life. The places I've been very lucky to be in the right place at the right time several times in my life, you know. And I'm still exploring my life. I mean, my life isn't over. I'm still every day interested in new things, exploring how I fit into all of it, you know. So it's an ongoing thing.
So the Art of Fluidity had a very successful film festival circuit run. Were you surprised at the response of the audiences after seeing your documentary, after getting a glimpse into your life? Were you surprised at the audience's response?
Yeah, very, very surprised, because... you know, you look at the film and you go, okay, here it is. It exists as a piece of art. Then you show it to the public and you've got no idea what they're going to think, you know. But I got to tell you, we had some really, really amazing and quite profound Q&A sessions. A lot of people thanked us, you know, for doing this the way we did it. A lot of people came out to us. A lot of people said to us, you know, thank you for showing some light on this that is really non-inflammatory. A couple of people said, it helps me to understand my son or my daughter. It was quite touching, actually. And I think I said when we were making it, I said to Fia, you know, if this turns out well, we might be able to help some people out there that are struggling with this issue. And I know that we have already, you know.
And you just said this issue. When you say this issue, what do you mean? Are you talking about people that may be transgender, that may be gender non-binary, that may be cross-dressers? How do you see it?
I pretty much see all those issues as the same issue, you know, which is basically honesty and being yourself. So anybody that's out there that's struggling with that, I mean, because of their social situation, their family situation, even their employment, you know, it can be very, very dangerous for them. And I was lucky that I didn't have to deal with any of that. As an artist, I mean, they expect you to do strange stuff, you know. They expect your lifestyle to be somewhat different.
To be eccentric.
So I never really dealt with, you know, blatant opposition, or it wasn't dangerous to my career, as it were. Mainly because I grew up in the 60s and I came of age in the 60s. And it wasn't an issue, you know. I mentioned in the documentary, everybody around me was experimenting, you know, gender blending, as they used to call it, trying on female clothes and, you know, trying out makeup and all that kind of stuff. It was just par for the course, you know.
When you were making this documentary, when did you guys film?
What do you mean? What time of the day?
No, like what? Like, was it pre-COVID, after COVID?
It was during COVID, actually.
And how was that process? Did you guys have to, you know, take precautions? Was it limiting to film because of COVID?
Yeah. Well, obviously it was limited because we couldn't go out and do interviews and stuff like that. It was just between us. There was the cameraman, Fia, and myself, you know. And we were careful. We kept our distance with each other, wore masks when necessary, you know. Yeah, that kind of set the tone for the whole thing. It was a weird period of time, as you know.
Mm-hmm. Especially to be doing a film, a documentary. Yeah.
Yeah. But we didn't have a crew as you usually would. Mm. yeah, it was kind of like our little hobby in a way that we were doing, you know.
There were a couple of times in well, I mean, I can relate on multiple levels to your story, but there are two specific moments in the documentary, Autobiography of a Yogi. I have that book. It's very thick. I've had it since the 1990s. I've tried to read it, but I couldn't get through it.
Really?
I'm just saying. Another aspect is Tibetan monks and them creating mandalas in Toronto in the 90s. I was fortunate enough to see that, because some monks were here in Toronto and creating this huge, beautiful mandala. And those aspects are in this documentary. So here's my question to you. What got you into meditating, into the spiritual aspect? What got you into this originally?
In 1967, I was given the autobiography by a bass player I knew. He was already a follower of Yogananda. And he gave him this book. And he said, here, read this. Because I was obviously like a lot of people in the 60s looking for my guru, you know, looking for some spiritual truth. And he said, read this. And it immediately connected with me. I mean, like a lot of people, I've heard say same thing, but the face on the cover just zapped me. His eyes are so intense, it just zapped me. And then I read it, and every page of it was like, yeah, okay, this is interesting. It was an insight once again into someone's life, you know. We hear about yogis in the Himalayas and all that stuff. But this was a yogi living in the United States, trying to establish his fellowship. And all the stuff he went through, it was quite amazing. And of course, as I say in the documentary, I got to the end and I was very disappointed that he died in 1952. And I said I was disappointed because I wanted a guru I could talk to, you know, like a shrink. I could go and sit down with him and have a heart-to-heart with him, right? And of course, that was a major sort of stupidity, dumb thing for me to say, you know. Because as you know from the documentary, I eventually met another guru called Sri Chimnoy. And I said, I'm so glad to meet you. You're my guru. And he said, I'm not your guru. And I said, well, do you know who is? And he said, yeah. I went, oh, fantastic. So who is it? And he said to me, I can't tell you. I said, what do you mean? You know who he is, but you can't tell him. What kind of a game is this, you know? He said, well, you have to find him yourself, and you already have, but you don't realize it. So once again, I was like, this is some kind of mind game this guy's playing with me. So I said to him, well, let me ask you this. Can you give me a clue? And he said, oh, yeah, yeah. He said, your guru isn't in the body. And as soon as he said that, I went, oh, you mean Yogananda? And he said, yeah. And I was like, oh, my God. What about all the time I'd wasted? Because I'd been 10 years. I'd been to TM, the Hare Krishnas, all these different gurus and religious leaders. And, you know, got the thing, did the money and the piece of fruit, got my mantra. None of it worked. So he said to me, you haven't wasted a second. Now he's ready for you and you're ready for him, because the communication is on a spiritual level, not on a physical level. So that was my sort of insight into that world. And I've been pretty faithful. I serve Yogananda in Los Angeles. He has a shrine here in Los Angeles. And I'm an usher there when they have services. Mm. So I'm quite close to it, you know. Well, you read it and it didn't take, huh?
Correct. I tried to read that book, but I could not get through it. And that is what it is. But it's there. Yeah. It's sitting right there in my little library.
Wow. So did you keep looking?
Did I keep looking? Oh yeah. Oh, absolutely. But you know, like certain things connect, other things don't, right?
Yeah.
So I'm curious to know, I'm interested in knowing, When you saw your film, your story, your life up on the big screen, did anything ever surprise you about what you saw, what was revealed in the final product, even though it is your life? Did anything jump out at you when you first saw it?
Yeah, there was one time, I think the second time I saw it, and I sort of, I'm able to watch it almost like detached, you know. It's like, first of all, you watch it as a piece of film, and there's a critique about the editing or whatever, right? The way the story is told and all the rest of it. But then it's me talking, right? And the thing I got the second time I watched it was there's a thread through my life. And that thread is to stick to my guns. I've always stuck to my guns, even though sometimes it's been uncomfortable. Sometimes I don't know why. I just know what I don't want to do, you know? So I've always stuck to that. And it came off pretty strongly to me. And I'm still like that. I know what I don't want to do. So don't keep asking me to do these things I don't want to do. You know?
Well said, well said. The title, Paula and Trisha, The Art of Fluidity. Is there a story behind choosing this particular title?
I don't know, because Fia chose that.
And were you happy with it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. In fact, I've always had a problem with all the labels, you know, in the past, like, you know, cross-dresser, all the different, you know. When I heard gender fluid, that really resonated with me. Oh, that's a very nice way of putting it. Yeah, I'm one of those. I'm gender fluid because I do go backwards and forwards. There isn't a set way for me. You know, it's however I feel, whatever mood I'm in. So, yeah, that made nice sense to me. It's not sort of harsh either. Gender fluid is a very nice way of putting it. Don't you think?
I do.
Yeah.
And on that note, we'll return after this Rainbow Country update.
I'm Sky Gilbert, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Terra.
This is gay hip-hop artist, the Mangfather Bob Katz. An artist friend of mine recommended that I check out Mark Tara's Rainbow Country years ago, and I've been enjoying it ever since. Mark's excellent interviews highlight all aspects of the LGBTQ community, and he's not afraid to ask the difficult questions that other hosts avoid. And I love, love, love the music that Mark plays on Rainbow Country each week, especially when he plays my music. But seriously, Mark Tara has been such a supporter of my music and has turned me on to so many great LGBTQ artists that I'd never heard of before. I'm so grateful to Mark Tara's Rainbow Country.
So, as you know, Rainbow Country airs on broadcast radio, streaming, and as an edited podcast. Most of those outlets and platforms are listener supported. So if you think what I'm doing here on Rainbow Country, working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond, is worthwhile, I hope you'll consider making a donation to this very outlet you are tuned to. If you happen to be listening to the edited podcast version, I hope you'll consider making a donation to an outlet that does carry Rainbow Country. How can you do this? Simple. Head over to marktara.com, where everything is connected, and hit the donation banner. That's where you'll find a list of all the outlets that carry Rainbow Country. a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. Let your voice, let your support be heard.
Hi, my name is Joanne Vanicola, and I'm an actor and a writer, and I was first on Rainbow Country with Mark Tara on discussing the massacre at Pulse Club in Orlando. I realized how important it was for our community to have a radio station specifically for our issues to talk about people in the LGBTQ community and to provide an outlet for our stories, to discuss our politics, culture, and give voice to the issues that matter to us. And, of course, our artists and the things that we do globally and talk about culture. And without people like Mark Tara providing a space for this with a radio show like this, then we wouldn't have that voice. So, support. Tune in. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Garrett Conley, author of Boy Erased, a memoir. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
So Paul Whitehead, you are a very successful visual artist. You've worked with the likes of Peter Gabriel, the Beatles, Genesis. You're also in the Guinness Book of World Records for creating the largest indoor mural. You're also part of the LGBT community. I'm curious to know, how do you see yourself? Do you see yourself as transgender, as gender non-binary, as a cross-dresser, as gender fluid? How do you see yourself?
I think the best way to put it for me is gender fluid. Because I do go backwards and forwards, and I'm very, very secure and safe with each of those manifestations. I love to be a guy and do all the guy things. And I also like to create this female character. And like I say in the documentary, I like to make the prettiest me that I can and manifest that in the world, you know. And of course, as I get older, that's more and more difficult, as we know, right? But why not? I mean, I take great sort of faith by some of the beautiful older women that I see in the world, you know. They're beautifully dressed. They're very secure in themselves. They don't care if they've got a few lines and so on, you know. Mm-hmm. It's just that manifestation. And I've always admired female clothes. When I was married, I used to very often select my wife's clothes for her, right? And she said, "You are uncanny. You've got this uncanny knack of just picking the perfect thing." And I never made a mistake. So that was something that was inherent in me. I like beautiful clothes. I like to look, you know, comfortably beautiful. You know what I mean? I don't like to be like all corseted in or all done up, you know. I like to be comfortable.
So the movie is called Paul and Trisha, The Art of Fluidity. And Trisha is essentially your alter ego. Does Paul allow Trisha to appear? Like, is there a feeling? Is there a sense that Trisha wants to come out? Or when do you decide? Or how is it decided?
Well, that's a good question. It's basically a frame of mind. I mean, people often ask me, you know, when you create art as Trisha, are you always dressed up? And the answer is no, I'm not. I can be Trisha wearing male clothes, you know. It's just a frame of mind I'm in. Mm-hmm. And it's actually a reaction to my male work. My male work is usually about ideas, expressing an idea or a concept. Very detail-oriented, requires a lot of drawing, a lot of working out, you know, perspective and all the rest of it. And the paintings take a long time because they're pseudo-realistic finish. You know, a painting can take me 3 months, and it's a matter of painting old-fashioned style. And, you know, there's a technique that I use, right? Tricia, on the other hand, is spontaneous. She doesn't think about what the net result is going to be. It's like, it's playful. It's like, okay, I want to play now. And just play around with paint and brushes and all the rest of it and see what happens, which is very different. And I also work as Tricia very, very fast. I don't hang around. I don't perfect the thing. If in fact, Tricia always says that if you start to see the hand of the artist, if you start to see the brush marks, then it's time to stop.
So let's, I want to talk about sexuality and gender and sexuality, because there's an aspect in the documentary that I thought was really, really fascinating. As Paul, you, I'm assuming sexually you would predominantly be more straight. Mm-hmm. But as Tricia, at one point you said that you like men, maybe you were finding, Tricia was finding herself more and more attracted to men. Mm-hmm. And I thought that that was so fascinating, because sexuality and gender, like, they're not necessarily, like, someone that may be, you know, a cisgender male might be straight. And let's say he discovers his feminine side and starts dressing up. His sexuality, which would be heterosexual, may change, and it may not. And I thought that that is so interesting and so fascinating, especially when you were expressing that in the documentary, that when you were Tricia, that you were saying that you know, hey, I just might be interested in men down the road. Can you talk to me about that?
Yeah, I always say to people, I'm heterosexual in both genders, and that's it. It's as simple as that. As a male, I'm interested in women and all the rest of it. As a male, I never see myself being gay. I never have any attraction towards males. As soon as Tricia puts on the female clothes, obviously you're presenting yourself to the world in a totally different way. And if you dress, you know, provocatively, you're a sex object, a female sex object, right? So yeah, it opens up that door, you know, and men become a possibility. Why not?
Did that surprise you at all, especially when you were first discovering this aspect of yourself in regards to Tricia, and the more that you lived as Tricia, those attractions to men, did it surprise Paul?
It didn't surprise me at all. But the interesting thing was, I did discover, and I don't want to sound sexist in this remark, but I did discover what pigs men are. The way they treat women is, and they treat you the same way. I mean, to all intents and purposes, you look and you act like a woman if you do it correctly, right?
So as you as Paul, did that influence how you treat women?
Oh, of course, yeah, yeah. Actually, I've been very lucky in my life to always have a very close, intimate relationship with women. Going back to when I was 8 years old, I had a very interesting experience at school. When I was 8 years old at my school, they announced they were going to have cooking classes. And I was like, oh, fantastic. I really wanted to learn how to cook. And then they said, oh, but it's for girls only. And so I was like, oh, what a drag. So I went home. I told my mother, I said, they have cooking classes at school and I can't join because it's for girls only. So my mother, who was always quite feisty, goes down to the school and says, this is ridiculous. My son should be allowed in the cooking classes. So I finished up in the cooking class, me and 30 girls. So from age 8 or 9, I had a really intimate relationship with girls. It was like girls to boys are like this weird kind of species, you know. I was actually interacting with them on a very intimate level, and cooking, you know. which opened up that door for me, and it made me realize, no, they're not weirdos. They're kind of interesting. I found the whole girl-female energy very interesting as well, the sort of nurturing energy. And so I was never afraid of girls. And in my dating years, I go out with my friends to the bars and everything, trying to pick up girls. And I was always very comfortable going up to girls and talking to them as girls, you know, complimenting on something, you know, oh, I like your earrings, or I like your sweater or your dress or something. And it was sincere, you know, and girls would respond to it. My buddies, who had all spent a few pounds on drinks, usually went home alone. So, yeah, I've always had a very close relationship with women as friends, you know.
Mm-hmm. When you are Trisha, and let's say you come across a man and he may not be treating you in the best way possible, do you ever find yourself, like, do you ever find Paul comes starts asserting himself to kind of check that man, put that man in his place?
Oh yeah. I mean, I say things like, you know, some guy comes up with
that, maybe like not ladylike to say or something.
Yeah. They come off with some line or something that's just really, really sexist, you know. And I look at them and I say, does that usually work for you? Because, you know, that's really fucked up, you know. And they look at me and they go, what? So, yeah, that's not the way to talk to women, you know. Mm-hmm. So why do you feel it's right to talk to me like that, you know?
It's interesting. It's almost as if you should be giving TED Talks in regards to heterosexual men, how to talk to, or maybe just like men in general, but how to talk to women, because they may be able to learn something from you because you've experienced it from both ends, from both sides.
I think so. I think guys that grow up in families where they have more than one or two sisters, they are more sensitive as well, right? But guys that grow up with the whole idea that girls are to be conquered, you know, they're notches on your gun, you know, those guys just don't have a clue, and they never will, you know. And they think my approach to it is sissy, you know. If you show any inclination towards appreciating women or admiring them or condoning their behavior, you're a sissy, you know. You don't understand. It's like you should be like us, you know, a macho man, you know. And I mean, look at the state of the world. That's where that gets you, you know.
You are a very talented visual artist. When did you begin to discover that aspect of yourself, that you had a talent for the visual arts, for drawing, for painting?
It was very early on. It was at school. Preschool, I always used to like to sit at the table with my drawing pad and some crayons and everything and just play around, you know. And I soon discovered that if I could imagine something, I could draw it. And so, of course, when I got to school, kids would challenge me. They'd go, hey, Paul, can you draw a horse with a fish's tail? I'd say, yeah, sure, here you go. And I'd draw it and give it to them. And it was almost like magic, you know. And then as I got into it a bit later, I discovered all these other artists, and I was lucky enough to have a teacher at school who spotted me and started to mentor me, you know. He would turn me on to different artists, and I'd go to museums with him and stuff like that, because he saw my raw talent. And the more I learned, the more I realized, oh, this is fun, you know, you can do this for a living. Wow. It was kind of an eye-opener, because nobody in my family agreed with me. My father wanted me to be an architect or an engineer or something useful, you know.
Does the visual arts and that talent run in your family?
No, not at all.
You're the only one.
My brother's a musician and also a painter. And with the 7 years between us, and as we are growing up, We both used to say, like, we're the weirdos of the family. You know, what's going on here? You're into music. I'm into painting. And nobody in our family appreciated it. It was like a sort of unnecessary skill that we had. You know, it wasn't going to get us a living. It wasn't going to make us rich, you know. But we both stuck to our guns. My brother is very much like me. He sticks to his course and he does what he wants to do. He's actually a very excellent musical instrument maker. Hmm. His instruments have been exhibited in museums and so on, right?
Wow.
So we're very similar, yeah. Yeah.
Earlier I mentioned you worked with the likes of Genesis, the Beatles. You created some album art for some of these artists. Talk to me about, I believe it's the White Album by the Beatles. How did that come about for you, that you created cover art for the White Album for the Beatles?
At the time, this is like around 1970. At the time, I was the art director of Time Out magazine in London, which is a sort of a very popular What's On magazine. And the word got around that the Beatles were looking for art directors because they were doing this new record and blah, blah, blah. And it was sort of trendy to have an art director. So I said, oh, okay. And a friend of mine worked there and he said, well, I can get you an audition if you want, you know, an interview. And I said, sure. He said, which one would you like to interview with? And at that time, I was very much into John Lennon. I wish I'd have said George Harrison, because I think that would have been a much more interesting choice, you know. So he said, okay, I'll get you an interview. So I went along for my interview with John Lennon, and I was shown to this room, and there's John and Yoko sitting there. And they said, hi, how are you? Who are you? I said, well, I'm the art director of Time Out magazine. Oh, yeah, love the magazine, love the magazine. Little chit-chat. And then they said to me, okay, in the next room, there's something in there. We'd like you to go in there and then come back and tell us what you think about it. So, okay, so I go in the room. And the Beatles' office was on Savile Row in London, which is where they make all the men's suits, you know, all the high-end men's suits. Laying on the floor was a men's suit, and it was about 10, 12 feet long. It was huge, right? And it was pinstriped, you know, classic pinstripe suit, just laying on the floor. And there was a stool in the corner of the room, and obviously you were meant to sit on the stool and come up with your thoughts. What are you going to say about this, right? Well, I quickly realized that it was like a mind game, and the mind game was, if I stay in here too long and think of something to say, they'll think I'm not smart or I'm stupid or something, right? However, if I come out too fast and say something really, really wacky, that would work against me as well. So I sat there, what am I going to do? What am I going to do, right? Playing these head games with myself. So in the end, I thought, well, wow, I've been here for 2 minutes. I better get back out and say something, right? So I walked back out. And I said the first thing that came into my head, which was, it's really great, but I would have liked it better in gray flannel. And they went, fantastic. Yeah, great. Lovely. Great. And I got the job. But the thing was, I got the job, but I never saw them again after that. My job was basically to handle different projects. Give this to this guy. And can you deliver that to this guy? And of course, do my own design, which was a design of the Beatles, like Mount Fadmore, four Beatles in a mountainside. And what happened was, each one of the Beatles had different art directors. I think Paul had four art directors and Ringo had one. They all had these different guys. They finished up with so much art and good art, you know, they couldn't decide what to do. So in the end, they said, well, we'll just do a white cover. And that was the story. So my art director at Apple was very, very weird, very short-lived. And it was kind of, I was filling a post because they had to, you know?
Mm-hmm. Were you happy with your Mount Fadmore, your Mount Rushmore of the Beatles?
Yeah, yeah.
I think because you show it in the documentary, it's beautiful.
Yeah, it worked quite well. And I even got the faces in similar poses to the faces on Mount Rushmore. know, John Lennon is George Washington, looking straight ahead. I think George is Lincoln. And it works out well, yeah. Yeah.
There's also a segment in the documentary where you talk about you were part of a short documentary that Peter Gabriel created an original song for. And I believe that song is played in the documentary as well.
Yes.
That, how did that make you feel, having an original song by Peter Gabriel?
Well, the way it worked, I'd worked with Peter Gabriel and knew him quite well, right? We shot the film, and the film was shot in a very unusual way. There was a camera in the 70s and 80s called a Pixel 2000. It was basically a children's camera made by Fisher-Price, and it was a very crude digital camera. And you recorded the image onto cassette tapes, right? And it became like a cult thing. A lot of directors used this camera because it was difficult to work with to make short films and so on, right? So that's how the film was shot. And it turned out quite well. And then the director said to me, "Hey, Paul, do you think you could get Peter Gabriel to do the music?" And I said, "Yeah, sure, right, yeah, no problem," right? And then I thought about it, and I thought, well, Peter Gabriel is kind of quirky. He likes unusual things. Maybe the fact it's made on this camera might appeal to him. So I said to Bart, the director, "Look, send it off to him with a note from me and see what happens." So he sent the film off, and nothing happened for a couple of months. Then it came back, and he put the music on it for us, which was great. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Peter.
Yeah.
So, Paul, here's my last question for you. Your documentary, what do you hope audiences come away with after they've seen your documentary, after they've gotten a glimpse into your life, Paul and Tricia, The Art of Fluidity?
A couple of things. I hope that it helps diffuse all this nonsense that's going on right now about the LGBTQ issues and everything, right? I hope it sort of teaches people that there are many lifestyles, you know, and I'm not at all unique, but it's kind of a window into my life. It might help you understand, might help you with one of your relations or your children that you're dealing with this issue. It might help you to understand more, you know. I hope that's what happens.
Well said, well said. Paul Whitehead, well said, well done, well lived your life and continuing, obviously. Yes. I have to say thank you for your time. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you. And read the autobiography. Give it another shot.
I just may do that.
Okay.
I have to say thank you again for your time, and be well.
And you, man. Thank you.
As an artist, Paul Whitehead interpreted the world around him.
Here we are, the playground. Welcome to my world.
Creating dazzling works of art for legends in their time.
Over the course of my career, I've worked with some really great people, like Peter Gabriel, Peter Hamill from Van de Graaff, Genesis art director with John Lennon and the Beatles.
But despite his success, the one thing Paul couldn't express.
You learn very early on that what you do for a living as an artist doesn't conform with most people's norms.
Was his true self.
So they think you're a weirdo.
Until he...
To me, the actual transition takes place when I put the wig on.
Discovered her.
Power. Realize your power.
Go where you want to go.
I realize she's an identity. I want to be the prettiest me that I can be with all the physical handicaps I've got. So without thinking what you're doing, you just start work. I have this ambition to be the transgender Bob Ross.
Paul Whitehead,
I discovered that I didn't fit into a box.
Trisha Van Cleef.
By not fitting into that box.
Two people enjoined together by art.
You were going to upset people.
After a lifetime of artistic achievement.
As an artist, as a transgender person.
He learned his masterpiece.
It's not my purpose in life to make other people feel comfortable.
May have been herself.
My purpose in life is to make me feel comfortable.
Paul and Trisha. The Art of Fluidity.
You can stream Paul and Trisha, The Art of Fluidity,